Hi, this is Adam Platt, New York Magazine food critic, and you're listening to Food Fridays on The Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC 93.9 FM, AM 820, and WNYC.org.
The future is always difficult to predict, but my next guests are going to give it a shot. Food and wine editor-in-chief Dana Cowan sent paper plates to designers, chefs, artists, and other food folks and asked them to draw what they think we will be eating 35 years from now. The results for 2048 turned out to be thought-provoking and in some instances a little scary. Dana Cowan is here along with Dan Barber, the chef and co-owner of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, and Dave Arnold, the French Culinary Institute's Director of Culinary Technology and a partner at Booker and Dax. And I'm very pleased to welcome all three of them to our show today to talk about the Plate Project and the future of food. By the way, you can see many of the plates on our show page at WNYC.org. We've made them available. Dana, was there a common theme on most of the plates that you received?
Well, people were really had visions, you know, either dystopian, utopian, but they all predicted vegetables, plants, animals, and some of them were desiccated, fried. So I'd say the theme was...
Well, how is that any different than what we eat today?
Well, that was the question. You know, are we going to change our habits? Are we really just going to sort of put blinders on and move ahead? Some people saw abundance and some people saw absolute devastation.
Well, is climate change a theme?
Climate change is a huge theme. What are we going to do to our environment now that is going to make us have something to eat in the future? Are we going to change our behavior or are we just going to keep on destroying things?
And what did you put on your plate?
My plate was rays of sunshine because I'm a big optimist.
Oh, nice. I can remember a time when the future food was going to be whole meals in pill form. Dave, have we gotten more imaginative when it comes to envisioning the future of food?
Well, I mean, I think to your point, everyone always thinks, oh, technology, food is going the way of the pill. And in fact, I hope that never, ever happens. As a person who's been working with technology for years in food, I mean, that's not the goal at all. You know, the goal is to make things more delicious, which is not to say more pill-like.
Yeah, well, it took all of the sensory pleasure out of eating. Some of us like that part of the eating a lot. Dan, you submitted three plates of charting the evolution of a steak dinner.
Yes, sir.
And how do you think the steak dinner will look in 2048?
So the first plate was a look back at sort of like the 60s, 70s, 80s, where you had the big steak dinner was sort of took center stage, and a bit of vegetables, a little bit of grain maybe, to today's, you know, fashionable farm-to-table movement. But when I looked at it from the conception of a plate, which Dana asked me to do, it was the same sort of setup. You still had the 7-ounce portion of steak, although now it was a grass-fed steak, and the vegetables were still there, but they were organic or local, and the grains and whatnot. So I was sort of thinking that in the future, we need to radically rethink the structure of the plate, where the protein, the center cut of meat, for example, stops taking center stage, and we become more imbalanced. We become more balanced in sort of an ecological perspective, which is to say probably less meat, but not no meat, just
but
better balance.
You sound kind of optimistic.
No, I'm a cynic. What are you talking about? I've never been accused of being optimistic in my life. No, I am. I actually am in that perspective. I think most chefs would say that the future of food is probably going to be pretty delicious because there isn't anything really gastronomically evolved from a 7-ounce portion of center cut meat. It's not really delicious. And if we can use technology and culinary wisdom in the future, I think we can probably make more delicious food.
So, Dave, what was on your plate?
I just deep fried my plate.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, look,
you think deep fry is the future?
I think it's the past. It's the future. Deep frying is an incredibly great cooking technique. It's just amazing. It applies heat from all sides relatively rapidly. It creates delicious crusts. It, you know, most people can't fry very well at home, but that's just a lack of equipment and poor training.
So should I buy a deep fryer?
Oh, yes. Most
but
certainly.
What about my cholesterol?
Well, I think there are some people who need to limit their fat intake, and then there's others that don't. I mean, we live in a – remember Sleeper? Remember the movie Sleeper? Mm-hmm. All goes around and comes around. what's good and what's bad. You know, I lived through butter being bad, and then I've lived through butter being good again. And I find that if you just eat a reasonable amount of things that you enjoy eating, that you're going to be fine.
Well, Woody Allen is the one who suggested that we'll – was one of the people who suggested we'll be eating pills in the future.
Yeah, tongue-in-cheek. Yes, I mean
– We had a whole range of plates that were three-dimensional. The fried plate was one that we were actually very worried about, you know, whether the bugs would come and eat his fried plates. We put it aside.
There was nothing on the plate, just the – just the plate itself was fried?
It was battered and deep fried.
Yeah. We had a plate of grass that was covered in grass with a bright orange fork. We had a ceramic it was plate of carrots and other vegetables that some of them were rich and beautiful, like the soil was healthy, and the other half of the all those vegetables was white, and that was the factory future. Uh-huh. We had a Marcel Duchamp plate that was a light bulb screwed into the plate that was actually talking about the future of the relationship between the restaurant and the artist, and it was done by an artist who has traded their work for food, saying that that's never going to change, the relationship between art and food.
So did chefs have different sense of the future than the food writers or the artists?
I think that the chefs often focused on what literally would be on the plate. So is it going to be a steak or not? And the thinkers tended to be more metaphorical. Someone like Nathan Meyerwald, who is a technical wizard, he gave us three-dimensional food that was a printout.
Well, he's already been predicting the future. He was on our show to talk about how many volume cookbook thing that he has all about the future of cooking.
Yeah. 42, yes. 40 weights, 42 pounds, that book.
But luckily, you didn't get a hold of it because you would have probably deep fried it. I've been thinking about your dish. If you put salt on it, you could call it a salt and battering.
That would be a good one. In fact, I did salt it. I can't let a fried thing go out without salting it. That's just poor practice.
Now, Dana, did
I didn't taste it. I should have.
Yeah. Well, it's a little stale now at this point.
Didn't a few contributors suggest that insects are the future of food?
There's an illustrator named Peter Arkell who actually drew a grasshopper and pointed out where the steak would be, where the shoulder chop would be. So he basically took an insect and reinterpreted it as a cow.
Well, insects have a lot of protein and few calories. So, Dan, can we expect to see crickets and ants on the menu of
Blue
Hill
anytime
soon?
I had a nice dish at Noma with ants. It's been kind of the rage. You've heard about this.
Sure.
Right?
Rene Redzepi is very interested in insect food. And
those are live ants.
And Alex Italia in San Paolo is trying to draw people's attention to the Amazonian rainforest cuisine, and I think he was the first to really open our eyes to this. And Renee served me a local interpretation with ants. It was fantastic. Yeah. It was really delicious.
I hear some grubs are quite nice. Yeah. I don't like grasshoppers much, though. I've had them
in Mexico. They deep fry them.
Yeah, but
you get them in Oaxaca.
They're crunchy.
Yeah, people misjudge the deep frying. When you deep fry everything until it's just crunch, it's just crunch. Yeah. There's an art to deep frying.
But the thing about insects is that they don't have much flavor. They take on the flavor of the thing that you cook them in.
They're the chicken of the ground.
Really?
I'm just guessing.
I mean, presumably the ants have some formic acid in them, right? Dan, how would they taste?
Yeah, well, I got a big lemongrass burst. I mean, that was the beauty of that dish. I mean, you were tasting little pellets of lemongrass. It was delicious.
Yeah. That's the characteristic of ants, the formic acid.
Yeah. My guests are Dave Arnold, Dan Barber, and Dana Cowan. We're talking about the future of food, or at least as various people have envisioned it. Isn't the way we eat today determined in large part by class? Wealthy people can eat organic, locally sourced fresh food because they can afford it, and poor people are often stuck with low-quality, high-calorie processed foods. Dana, if current wealth inequality continues, will the gap in plates continue to widen?
I think the gap in plates is an enormous problem that we all need to focus our attention on solving, and trying to get healthy foods into poor neighborhoods is vital.
Not to plug my plate or anything, but I would answer your question by saying my plate was a lot cheaper in the future than the one we currently, the one that currently predominates the American table. And talking about insects and and using culinary techniques, old like deep frying and other techniques that Dave Arnold's invented over the years, makes food cheaper and I think more accessible to more people.
Well, do we have to rely on market forces, or what about government subsidies? Right now, government subsidizes foods that most people would consider to be less healthy.
Yeah, that 7-ounce steak is mostly from our tax dollars going to support the kind of grain that goes to feed animals that probably shouldn't be getting so much grain. So reinterpreting the plate is also about reinterpreting the political support of certain crops and the ecological realities that we're going to face in the future, which is that we're probably not going to be able to produce the kind of food we're producing now.
Although we see what happens when politicians try to get involved with issues like health. Dana, Michael Bloomberg has had his wrist slapped.
Yes, I think we should all be drinking fresh squeezed orange juice.
Dave, one of the large contributors to the obesity problem is food deserts. How can problems like food deserts be solved?
Like crappy supermarkets?
Or no supermarkets, right. or supermarkets. I've gone into supermarkets where all of the produce is wrapped in saran wrap and looks like it's just inedible. And then you go to some other neighborhood and everything is kept beautiful, and they actually have people going around. I'm not sure it's a good idea, but they have people going around spraying all the produce.
Sure.
They missed it.
I used to shop in those neighborhoods. You know what I mean? I used to live in those neighborhoods when you're in school, and it's horrible. Those places are horrible, and it's very difficult to make good choices. But the real issue is it's a cycle very difficult to break out of, because you have a group of people who can afford a certain thing that seems okay. And, that's part of the American dream, that I can put a 69-cent plate of chicken, no matter how crappy it is, on my plate and feel like a real honest-to-goodness American, and I'm giving really good stuff to my kids. And so who's going to tell a mother trying to feed, a group of kids, and she's probably working, a million hours a week anyway, that she shouldn't buy that 69-cent chicken at her low-quality supermarket? That is elitist. Right. But then on the other hand, in order to have that much chicken, which is what she wants, it needs to be of a crappy variety. The stores in the bad neighborhoods aren't going to carry the higher end stuff because it won't move. And so you're in a cycle where we need everything to change. We need the subsidies that subsidize bad food to change, and we need the education to change.
Well, what about education? Go ahead, Dana.
Lori Silverbush's recent documentary, maybe you've seen A Place at the Table, which addresses these issues quite directly, because you see in that movie people living in these food deserts and the choices that they make, calorie for calorie. It's so hard to make the right decisions if, the really bad food is going to give you more calories. You just end up with an obesity, poverty food problem.
The problem, too, is a little bit of the term. I mean, deserts, indicates or suggests that it was a natural occurrence that there's no supermarkets in these areas. It's really not true when you look back at the history of inner-city subsidies were for fast food. I mean, that's how they all got into their low-rent, subsidized business models and thrived because of it. So I don't know. Deserts always strikes me as this probably the wrong way to look at it. And for the future, it circles back to your question about the political influence here, because we do need to pull those levers to change that situation.
And part of the equation is the farm bill. We'll take a little break when we come back. Maybe we'll talk about that and some other things. My guests are Dana Cowan, who is the editor-in-chief of Food and Wine, Dan Barber, the chef and co-owner of the Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns Restaurants, Dave Arnold, the French Culinary Institute's director of culinary technology and also a partner at Booker and Dax. Stay with us for more.
Well, he's fully recovered, except for a few minor kinks.
Has he asked for anything special?
Yes, this morning for breakfast. He requested something called wheat germ, organic honey, and tiger's milk.
Oh, yes, those are the charm substances that some years ago were felt to contain life-preserving properties.
You mean there was no deep fat? No steak or cream pies or hot fudge?
Those were thought to be unhealthy. Precisely the opposite of what we now know to be true.
Incredible.
A little clip from Woody Allen's Sleeper, where scientists have just thawed him out 1,000 years into the future, trying to figure out what to feed him. The concept of what's healthy has changed. But the concept of what's healthy is constantly changing, isn't it, Dana? If you look back at old issues of Food and Wine, don't you see all sorts of things there that you now might be horrified by?
I think that we used to focus on fat, for example, as the way to if you cut fat out, you're going to be healthy. But I feel that moderates, people who have a very good, healthy diet and they just eat modestly, that has never changed. So I think that the things that change are the fad diets, the paleo diet,
The grapefruit diet.
Grapefruit diet. Oh, my gosh. The diets through the ages are dramatic
and
not useful.
The all steak diet, the Atkins diet.
The cookie diet.
Yeah. Well, but
there was a cookie diet. I missed
that
one.
And there was a time when we were told that we shouldn't eat butter. Dan, at your restaurant, you serve something that I've never seen before, which is butters from one cow.
Yeah. Single utter butter, Leonard. Yeah.
What's her name?
It depends on the day. Yeah. Depends on the week. Well, Blue Hill Farm is a dairy farm, so we have the luxury of choosing which ladies to pick for the week, and we make butter from them. But it's a nice way to introduce the idea that the different breeds of cow produce different flavors of butter.
But we are no longer talking about oleomargarine or other things as a good substitute for butter.
Joan Gusow said that best. Yeah. She said, I trust cows more than I trust chemists. And she was right. She said that in the 70s. And she,
yeah, what about margarines, they taste bad. They taste bad. Like game over right there. They have bad taste. You know what I mean? And
but is it in moderation like wine?
But the thing is that you don't want to consume things that taste bad in moderation. Usually when you eat something bad, it's because it's supposedly healthy, which is a nightmare in itself.
I meant butter.
Oh, butter. Oh, in moderation? yes. I mean, like, everything should be in moderation, right? I mean, that's the whole trick of living. I mean, I'm generally immoderate about most consumption things, but, you know, I'm an outlier. We should be moderate in all things.
I always loved Julia Child on butter. She would, she would take a recipe and it had a stick of butter in it, but it was for 12 people. So how much butter are you really talking about? So I feel like, as long as you think about it that way, so many of these things that you think are evil are really just quite delicious.
Right. Would you prefer to stint on the butter and then not be sated by the food and then eat twice as much of that food? No.
But one of the hot diets proposed by some scientists anyway is the Mediterranean diet, and that uses olive oil rather than butter. Is olive oil better for you?
I mean, I've been looking at that study rather carefully, and I'm not prepared to make a statement about it. But all correlative studies I have issues with, because they no matter how well those things are controlled, they're very multifactorial. And a lot of the ones that I spend a lot of time with, like the DASH studies on salt and things like that, I find that most of their results are bunk. And so, in terms of like when you actually analyze what they're looking at, it's too new, and I haven't had the time to fully look at it yet, but I'm not prepared to say that it's bad science. But
without looking at the science, you can look at the ecology, and we don't live in the Mediterranean. So I have a problem with I like the idea of the cuisine cultural aspect that you ate from what the land offered, and that's a very lovely way to be in the world and to experience food. So I think there's something to learn there. I don't know that shunning butter in favor of olive oil is the future of food for where we're sitting anyway, for our ecology. Look, the Hudson Valley was built on dairy. Those beautiful landscape open pastures was built by dairy farmers, and we ought to, if we want to support that kind of landscape and that kind of ecology, be supporting it through milk and through dairy.
And Americans are doing that. Later in the show, we're going to be talking about cheese, and we're eating a lot more cheese now than we even did 30 or 40 years ago.
So, and there's a lot more great American cheese than there was 30 or 40
years ago. And
that's because
we're making it.
Yes, we are.
There are an awful lot of local cheeses being made these days.
Yeah. The problem with what Dan was saying, we shouldn't all switch to olive oil because we don't make it here. But that's the point, is that we're all going to switch. Now everyone's going out and they're saying, oh, I'm going to switch everything, because we have a magic bullet philosophy of what's going on. And that's the main issue with U.S. food thinking, is that a study comes out and we're like, oh, if I just switch everything to fish and olive oil now I'm going to be A-okay. No. Like, we got to stay away from magic bullet. Dan's thinking about what to eat based on a much more complicated set of criteria than what study came out this week. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Or Michael Pollan, who did a plate for us, who said, eat food, not too much.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple.
And mostly vegetables, he says.
And mostly vegetables, he would say.
I like the idea of the future of a plate of delicious food coming from what the land is telling you it wants to grow, which sounds like a very Luddite, old Shaker Village kind of conception of food, but I actually think it's quite futuristic if we become more literate in what ecological influences are telling us are most delicious. That's the job of a chef to curate.
Isn't that a lot easier in the Imperial Valley of California than it is in New York?
I don't know about that.
Winter and...
We just talked about cheese production. Some of the most exciting cheesemakers are happening in New England. Some of the best milk production possibilities are happening in New England. Some of the best root vegetable production because of the cold winter freezes that produce that delicious sweet carrot, which was, by the way, the centerpiece of my plate. Not to plug my plate again. but we have some advantages here that I don't think have been exhausted nearly enough. And it's local. And when the real costs of producing food in, where did you say, the Salinas Valley or in places in California and Arizona and Texas where most of our food comes, or Mexico or China, where most of our food increasingly comes from, the real cost of producing that and getting it here, when that catches up to us, I think we're going to look at the comparative advantages of what we have, which is the possibility for delicious food, but it's not olive oil.
And doesn't the first freeze actually make some vegetables sweeter?
Well, they convert starches to sugars. Sure, they want to survive, and that's delicious. That's what a plant physiologist told me. That he said, what you're tasting is sweetness, but what the plant is telling you is it doesn't want to die, and that's something we should take advantage of.
And then we killed it, yeah. But that's a whole other issue. I mentioned earlier the Farm Bill. Almost all of our agriculture subsidies are determined by the Farm Bill. Do you think, Dave, that the Farm Bill needs to be reformed?
Quite clearly. But, I don't really – it's such a complicated problem. I don't really know how anyone would approach it from a policy standpoint.
Well, what would a sensible Farm Bill look like?
It's one of those problems that someday someone will solve it, and until they do, it just seems intractable. I don't know. What is something that a politician could get elected and also say that they were going to do?
Well, the problem for politicians is that the people who support them with money are usually the people in agribusiness rather than the small farmers.
Sure. So how's that going to change?
Right. Well, usually we haven't had the vote, and the blue states, the urban centers haven't really had a vote in the Farm Bill, in part because historically, at least recently, the last 30 years, we've traded those votes for other issues that are supposedly more important for urban residents, like gun advocacy, like all the host of other issues that we feel are more important for, or the politicians feel are more important for their constituency. So part of all of this is talking about food as an issue that's important to urban eaters that translate into a Farm Bill that represents better food.
Dana, did any of the people who submitted plates address food subsidies?
There's no food subsidies among these.
I did. Because if you take away the subsidies of that 7-ounce steak, you end up having a steak that you can't afford. Mm.
That was on a higher plane,
yeah,
Dan.
Okay.
That actually wasn't on
the
plane.
We had to read into that.
That required explanation.
Corn was harmed in my plate, by the way.
Dan Barber, Dave Arnold, and Dana Cowan were talking about the plate project that Dana Cowan, editor-in-chief of Food and Wine, instituted, and it's still going on?
We've collected about 60 plates from thinkers of various kinds, chefs, artists, creators, and the reason it continues to go on is we'll take some of the plates and we'll auction them to raise money for sustainable agriculture. And we'll also do an art show with some of the plates, although Dave Arnold, our guest here, I'm not sure if his won't have disintegrated by the time.
Remember, I'm a former art guy. I think that thing's archival. I think it's good to go.
You think it's good? Yeah. We actually have been talking about what we could put on your fried plate to make it last longer and make a collector who buys it have it, for more than just a few months.
I can also refry it. That's how a lot of food stuff works is, you call me later, I refry it to the same specs. I'll just give you a piece of paper. Here is the spec, and then you can refry it.
It's like a restaurant. You just make the same dish again and again and again, don't you?
Or it's like Saul LeWitt. He's going to paint on your wall. He'll refry your plate. I like that.
Well, Dave, are many of the current food systems ecologically unsustainable? Can the planet really survive a future in which we're flying blueberries in from Chile in the middle of January?
I mean, to some people, yeah. I mean, there's rich people, and, you know, rich people can afford to do whatever they want. That's because they're rich. But I think that the, you know, obviously on balance, no, it's not sustainable the way it is.
Although we all rely on warmer states to give us oranges.
Sure. And some of that stuff's more efficient. Some of that stuff's more efficient.
Bananas.
Some of that stuff's okay. Do you know what I mean? In other words, like, we don't actually, like I disagree with Dan a little bit here. Like, we don't do everything the best here in the Empire State. I love our apples. I love a lot of our stuff. You know what I mean?
But we import our apples from other states, even though we produce so many apples
ourselves.
That's
a nightmare. That's a nightmare. Don't get me started on that. But I mean, there are many things that are produced more deliciously elsewhere. Peaches, for example.
And so let's address that a bit more, Dan. Is locavorism practical on a large scale? Could a place like New York really feed itself year-round on just locally grown food?
Are we talking 100%? Is that what you're... Is that where we,
well, that's what
is that the criteria? I don't know.
If you were in some other places in the world, everything would be coming from just.
Yeah, I don't have a
problem.
What's wrong with citrus fruit? I mean, I love citrus fruit.
Salt.
Salt's pretty good. Sugar,
good product. Salt.
There are people who call the locavore movement just another fad.
You know, you said that to me when I was on the air, I think 8 years ago, and so far we seem to be talking about it more and more. It's evolving into something that seems to be more complex, and I think the movement's probably growing to a mainstream consciousness that even you, Leonard, couldn't have predicted 8 years ago.
I think one of the interesting things about locavorism, if you look at someone like René Redzepi, is he's changed the idea of what you can eat, what is edible, and it makes you question, like, why is it that we eat such a narrow range of foods, like why rosemary but not pine? You know,
well, he's foraging for things, including because I remember I talked to him about this. He will go into the ocean and take out seaweed and salt water as well, and cook with salt water. Now, I would be a little reluctant. Maybe the salt water is cleaner.
How would you
Denmark
feel about ants on your plate?
Yeah.
Well, I've eaten,
Leonard, what's on your plate?
I've eaten insects in cockroach and crickets in Mexico. They were cooked. And I'm here to tell a tale.
Yeah, but they're not much to those things,
no,
right? They weren't that interesting.
One crunch and they're gone.
They're gone. except for the little leg stuck in your teeth.
But, well, if they run around in your saliva system. But that's a whole other issue.
But the beauty of chefs, just to go back to your point, is this really realistic? Because I do stress that 8 years ago, you wouldn't have been thinking. Everyone was saying that local food, locavores, was a fad. And do you think that today? I mean, I think it's
depends
just beginning.
Some members of my audience will still say, you know, this is all elitist stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it can be. It can be horribly elitist. But on the other hand, it's like can be awesome, too. I mean, like, how much fun is it to figure out what happens to be delicious near you and then find good uses for that?
Or
on a very simple level, you know?
What if you were a micro locavore and the next phase of locavorism was your own garden? Yeah. You know, what if you had a green wall and the food that you were eating was the food that you were growing vertically?
Rooftop gardens, right?
I mean, I feel
we weren't talking about rooftop gardens 8 years ago. Nor were we talking about whole ecological systems that feed a plate of food. We were talking about, you know, a grocery store list of locavores. You know, what could you get locally and the rest of it you would buy in the big food chain. That's changing, too. So that's an involvement that I think is probably pretty positive for this movement. I don't think it's a fad.
Well, when you started Blue Hill at Stone Barns, you were one of the rare restaurants that grew much of its own food, although this is not uncommon in Europe. No. In other parts of the world.
Yeah,
now we have a whole bunch of people doing. Tom Colicchio has his own garden right here in New York City, and we're seeing a lot more rooftop gardens and other spaces being used to grow food. Is that because of the influence of the locavore movement, or just that people like the idea of being able to grow their own and eat it fresh?
I think it goes back to what Dave said. I mean, it's delicious. This wouldn't be working unless the food really tasted better, because this movement is all – it's hedonism, you know, A to Z. So if it wasn't more delicious, we would be saying that – remember when we used to talk about local food a few years ago. And that's to me, is the power – of this for the future, is that we're really talking about better food that's better for you, that's better for a local ecology, and that you know bodes well for increasing its influence in the future.
On the other hand, by the year 2050, according to the UN, there'll be an additional 2 billion people on the planet, and we'll have to find ways to feed them. Many people are saying it will be impossible without relying a lot more on genetically modified foods.
Right. But that makes a big assumptions. I mean, right now, we produce enough food to feed 12 billion people. So the question is, what are our diets going to require in 2050? And if our diets are going to require a 7-ounce steak for everybody who is moving into the middle class in China and beyond, you're right. We have a problem, and we probably need to invest heavily in genetic modification and other forms of agriculture to increase production on limited land. But if we can use technology, if we can use culture from magazines like Dana's, if we can use chefs to reinterpret what our diets need, I don't know that assumption holds up as much. That's the problem with we need to feed 9 billion people in 2050. It assumes that we're going to continue to eat the way we eat now.
But it also assumes that we can rely on technology.
Well, but the issue with it, take technology and driving like food costs down like that. I mean, part of the issue is if we strictly say we need to feed a lot of people with X amount of resources, you get into a situation where you have like incredible feed conversion ratios in chickens, let's say, right? And so like the research then goes to, okay, using less resources to make a chicken instead of saying, is that resource really best spent making a crappy chicken? Do you see what I'm saying? So it's like feeding more people more efficiently doesn't necessarily make it better. Efficiency is not the only standard by which we should measure things.
A listener, a blogger, you sent a plate and the project wrote, the two things I'll miss most in the future, good, fresh, wild fish and Twinkies. Mm. Dana, those two fishes.
Twinkies are back.
That wasn't.
Did Pabst buy them?
Kenji Alt, Lopez Alt. Yeah. Yeah.
Are they both endangered? Well, Twinkies are back,
no,
but.
They're back.
maybe short term.
What about fish? Wild fish seem to be endangered.
But there are certain fish that are being brought back and. Paul Greenberg, who wrote Four Fishes, actually did a plate for us, and on his plate are clams that are good for the environment, and he's all about the local American fisheries. There's sustainable fish out there. You need to find them and protect them.
A number of the plates you received brought up 3D printing as the future of food.
Oh, my God.
Dave, in what ways would 3D printing be used to make food preparation? I thought 3D printing only makes plastics.
You know, they can print anything. But look, there's various sophistication levels for this, but the goal of most people who are interested in 3D printing food, and I get this a lot, by the way, as a tech guy. In fact, I was given a 3D printer that could print this. It's paste. It prints like a paste. It's like a pablum paste. You know, basically at this point, the technology is you can form a food paste into any shape that you want. That's very often not that interesting because I can just mold a food paste into whatever shape I want. There are people working on a much more more sophisticated way of trying to grow muscles or grow meat analogs that actually function the way meat does, i.e. they have different ways of cutting, contracting when they're cooked, different textures. They have fat analog, muscle analog. So these people are working on that kind of a problem. But, you know, the goal that everyone has, it goes back to this Jetson idea that you're going to press a button and, you know, grandma's cookies are going to pop out. And I always say, God, I hope not. Like, you know, I like cooking. I like to cook, you know, and I like cooking for people. And I like the interaction that cooking is. And I don't want to push a button and have grandma's cookies come out.
In the future, are we likely to have refrigerators and plates that are linked to the web and our social media accounts?
I mean, if it ever becomes actually useful, like if it ever actually makes it so that, you know, my wife doesn't use the last little bit of milk and then I can't make her a cappuccino in the morning, then sure. You know, because
you blamed it on your wife.
Well, I mean, I do the shopping in my house. So if we run out of milk, I know that, you know, if I pour the milk, I know to get more. But, you know.
There are refrigerators right now that are connected, you know, if you take out your milk, it knows and it will tell you. It just seems.
Mine just beeps if it's kept open too long.
Oh, really?
It's really
yeah.
Annoying.
You have to upgrade.
I say, all right. I can't find the thing in the back.
Look, some of that stuff's going to happen. I mean, you know, early adopters will buy it and then eventually it'll be good. I mean, we're probably going to have RFID tags on everything within, you know, 20 years and it'll tell us that our shrimp is going bad now in case you don't have a nose. It will tell you that your shrimp is going bad.
Well, that doesn't sound like a bad idea.
No. I'm all for that stuff.
But you like the empirical, don't you? You want to smell it.
Always. Always.
Thank you all so much for being on our show. My guests have been Dana Cowan, who is the editor-in-chief of Food and Wine, who initiated the how did you come up with this idea for the play project?
We were celebrating our 35th anniversary at the magazine, and we always look forward. So I was like, well, we know already now. What are we going to eat 35 years from now?
And also with us, Dan Barber, the chef and co-owner of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, and Dave Arnold, the partner, well, the French Culinary Institute's director of culinary technology and a partner at Booker and Dax. It's been a real pleasure having all of you on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, Leonard.